Welcome to Weathering. Today we're talking about a paper identifying and categorizing bias in AIML for earth sciences. And this one's exciting to talk about for a couple of reasons. It was put out by a number of the members of NSF AI to ES, which has been doing a lot of great work at the intersection of geophysics and AI. So we're excited to cover this one. But there is a little bit of a shadow over this paper because that group, AI2ES, got their funding cut, terminated by NSF in the recent federal turmoil. I think that kind of like, we were just discussing a little bit of paper prep, and I think it's like we were kind of hoping for a sequel to this paper, and we're not sure if we're going
to
get it.
They even allude to a sequel. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of the members of the group, especially Amy McGovern, has been doing a lot of work to shine a light on their funding termination, talking about the importance of the organization. So hopefully that, you know, gets enough attention to change the situation. But or, you know, the coverage by Weathering may be the missing piece.
Yeah, the Weathering lobby. No one knows about it yet, but it's super PAC Weathering.
Yeah. What's interesting about that group is they're, unlike most other groups working in AI for weather, they are, or Earth systems, they're really looking much more at the social and the use side, particularly like, you know, their full name is about trustworthy AI in climate and weather and coastal oceanography. And that's a pretty unique niche, but also really important.
That's right. So one of the blurbs is AI2ES has not only been working on specific AI-related science projects, they've been doing the important work of developing research approaches to ensure that the AI techniques developed will be usable for and trusted by scientists. They have also been conducting social science research on how the public will utilize and trust or not AI developed output for applications like weather forecasts and warnings. That, I think, really encapsulates their mission and I think perfectly kind of tees up the paper that we're going to talk about. Marta, you want to hit us with the abstract?
Sure. Artificial intelligence can be used to improve performance across a wide range of Earth system prediction tasks. As with any application of AI, it is important for AI to be developed in an ethical and responsible manner to minimize bias and other effects. In this work, we extend our previous work demonstrating how AI can go wrong with weather and climate applications by presenting a categorization of bias for AI in the earth sciences. This categorization can assist AI developers to identify potential biases that can affect their model throughout the AI development lifecycle. We highlight examples from a variety of Earth system prediction tasks of each category of bias.
My first question is, Alden, why do people keep separating AI and machine learning as two separate things in every paper that we read?
To be honest, I'm not sure. AI has really become such an amorphous term that it's both like a superset and maybe something different in some people's minds. To me, it's a superset of machine learning. And machine learning is by far the dominant paradigm at the moment used to implement AI, to the point that they have basically become one in many people's minds. Speaking of AI and machine learning in particular, this paper talks about bias. When a lot of people who do machine learning or AI work hear the word bias, they're often thinking of a particular statistical metric you can use to evaluate a model, which is just on average, is some particular output higher or lower than it should be. That's not the bias that we're talking about here. This bias, and I actually would love it if they had defined it in this paper, but my read in the type of bias that they're talking about here is uneven impacts on different groups of humans.
Yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge that bias in this definition and in this paper is both technical and social. And even just by using that language, I think that it makes a statement about like what you care about. So I think it's important that they do use that language, but maybe throughout our conversation, we can move to have an even more refined sense of what bias means. And I am actually going to move to even using another term, but I don't want to show all my cards yet.
Nice. Ooh, teaser. Now you have to listen to the whole episode, everyone. So before we get beyond the abstract, I was reading an AI to ES newsletter, the most recent one that was published before the funding was terminated. Anne Bostrom, who's one of the members and co-authors of this paper, had a quote that I liked almost better than any framing in this paper, but it's ultimately saying a lot of the same things. Crafting an AI model that is tailored to end user needs and is developed with those needs in mind is essential by our current standards to developing a trustworthy model. The level of uncertainty and accuracy may vary, but as long as they are clearly and effectively communicated with reliant stakeholders, then the road to trust is easier to traverse. I contrast that to a sentence in the intro that says, in this work, we build on our earlier research, which demonstrated multiple ways where AI could go wrong for environmental sciences and earth science applications. Here we focus specifically on the issue of bias, as it is one of the key threads throughout much of the recent work on ethical AI. I find that framing, my kind of knee-jerk reaction was like, there's this amorphous like going wrong. Whereas Anne's quote talks very much about like, there are gonna be different models created for different purposes, and it's really about fitting for purpose. And it can go wrong in ways that, and that's okay, as long as like that's a contract with like a social contract or even like a some technical contract with your users that they understand that and that still meets their needs. So I think that there's this like amorphous like going wrong where it's like this, it's not this perfect universal model for all users. And we'll get into it. Like they talk a lot more about this, but if you're reading the abstract and intro and then piecing out, there's a very positive way to talk about the same thing, which is like, hey, if you're using AI to build something in geophysics, especially if you're not coming from the domain or your team doesn't have folks representing the perspectives of potential users, it is essential that you take the time to understand and really focus in, how are people going to be using the thing that I produce, and like make it clear what its intention is. And then I think we can really accept certain biases as acceptable for that use case and reduce and be very cognizant of the ones that may cause harm to that specific user group.
Yeah, I think that the framing that they use here is almost one of harm reduction. And I do think that that's pretty common to take that approach, at least from what I've seen in other discussions of AI ethics beyond earth science. And so I kind of wonder if it's in step with these other conversations. But I think it's, yeah, the quote that you bring is super important. And they start to suggest that when we get into the conclusion. It's like this, the second or third to last sentence. Moving away from what they call the culture of developing AI models for any discipline needs to shift to one where all aspects of ML systems are documented. So I think that that starts to like get toward what you're saying of like building for specific use cases, but not as pointed.
What I want to get out of this paper is a roadmap or a checklist for what we need to look out for and what are some tools to reduce issues that might be prevalent, and where can AI potentially start to improve on biases and problems that we've had in existing models. This paper lays out a taxonomy of a number of different categories and subcategories of bias.
I think it could be helpful to give sort of the bird's eye view of what that diagram looks like, and it's very important for how they organize the categories. Like there's a logical framing here. So they start with systemic and structural bias as being this sort of like overarching category that then cascades through all of the following categories that they put forth: human bias, then data bias, and then finally statistical and computational bias. And all of these things interact with one another, and there is generally like a framework that follows the development process.
Yeah, just to emphasize that interaction portion, they say, in the development of an AI model, each type of bias may interact across categories. Thus, it's critical to understand each in order to develop and deploy AI models in an ethical and responsible manner.
One of the most interesting or even illuminating parts of this paper for me was just how they sort of mapped out how many choices are involved in the development process. And to speak to your earlier point, Alden, about how developers in context of AI are often thinking about bias as this kind of technical metric. The only part of bias that has like no connection to human hands is one subsection of the final category, which they just call AI bias. So that's bias that comes from the model within itself. And I say this just because I think that it goes to show how involved humans are in the development of these models, which is very different than the tune of, I think, the loudest people in AI generally and outside of earth sciences. And I actually thought that that was a pretty positive framing. For me, the implicit idea that we actually are very involved with these things and we have control over these choices that we make is one that I think is really empowering.
I don't find this paper empowering at all.
Do you want to talk about that?
It just goes back to the framing of it, but I think the whole introduction, when negatively biased models are deployed and then make the news, they can erode public trust in AI overall. Such models have already been deployed by private industry and government. I think that's like a direct contradiction, I feel like, to Anne's interview in the newsletter. She says, working with users to evaluate models in the first place is good, but to begin interaction as soon as possible. So like, how can you iteratively improve models if we're like worried that you're going to get in the news and then like ruin AI for everyone? Yeah, it's just so, it's so negative. And I tried to go through all of the citations. This maybe just meta commentary. I don't like academic papers, how they're written. Like, I wish I know our entire podcast is written.
You may be on the wrong podcast, sir.
I know. I'm sorry. And with that, I announce my resignation. No, I just wish, like, I don't like when critical details are in the citation. And I know that's necessary because otherwise every paper would be a bajillion lines. But like, I went through four different citations to try to find the specific examples and I couldn't find them. So it's like, you're just like going down this, you know, rabbit hole just to understand like the statement biased AI models can cause harm in a variety of ways, including affecting people's ability to obtain a job, have stable housing and more. To me, I'm like, is the work we do going to do that? I didn't feel like there was an acknowledgement that these challenges are evergreen for any decision support tool. AIML has only specificity to a couple of the subcategories of the taxonomy. But these biases are present in every forecast model, every decision support system that we can make, whether it uses AI or not. And I feel like that acknowledgement would be helpful to look at the prior art, like, how has numerical weather prediction tackled some of these? That's a many decades old field. Like, are there lessons to learn from that? And maybe that's what the sequel is. Like, now, okay, we have the taxonomy. The sequel is taking lessons learned from building these models that are subject to the same biases for decades. Like, what have we learned there that we can apply to AI?
Yeah, I mean, they do say, and I don't know if this is true, but they do say that for earth science applications, it's relatively new to consider bias. And I think they mean this kind of like social bias. Yeah, so I think that maybe this is actually more helpful to apply generally to earth science research versus just AI, even though that's what they have framed the paper around. I think the categories are super helpful, like thinking about the philosophy of science that they offer and engage with.
I'm not directly developing lots of AI models. So this is coming off as very defensive, as if I'm like being called out. I love the taxonomy. I love a lot of the points of the paper. I just don't love the upfront framing of it, because it goes on in the intro, and then we should go through the taxonomy quickly. It is not possible for AI developers to mitigate bias until they can identify it. So I think what that's saying is, hey, we have an opportunity to make it like bring people into this tent of understanding these biases so that the field, which is so fast moving, can identify and address these biases. So let's make it fun. Let's make it fun for that. Like, I mean, just with any, Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, you know, you got to be effusive with positivity and like make people see the upside of something. And I think the entire intro is showing the downside. And what would be the reason I like to back to Anne's just one last time is she shows the upside. And in terms that I think people that come maybe from a more technical background into this AI geophysics field, it resonates with them. They come from a world of product design, of UI UX development, of user interviews, and like understanding the job to be done of a customer or user. And I think I'll shut up because I'm just ranting on this one topic, but I think it's just so important. I think it's so critical, right? If I frame it as like, hey, startup, you're building a weather model, right? You think it's hot. Like, do you understand the user's needs? Here's like a taxonomy to do that. And we promise your product is going to be better. Your users are going to trust it more. Like, they will be able to make better decisions because you went through this checklist. Like, I just think I would be like, I have to eat this paper up. And then the impact of the paper is you've probably had more AI developers at the end of reading it, able to identify and like take out, you're just going to like get a better readership in.
Pitch to AI developers. This paper can be both a motivator to get your team excited and motivated to bring in users really early in the process. And if we think about it right, give you a roadmap and a checklist of things to look out for. As we go through this, I also, Marshall noted this a little bit, but many of these risks or harms are really general to most types of models. So I want to look out for the places where using an AI ML approach either has the potential to be a multiplier of the harms in particular, or offer some new ways to mitigate them that aren't available in other approaches.
Okay. We're gonna go through each of the categories of the taxonomy so that you know what the heck we're talking about. So the first one is systemic and structural bias, which are biases that are present in the background structure of society or the institution where data may be measured. So that includes historical bias, social bias, and institutional bias. Historical bias being like spatial temporal gaps due to, you know, just the density of measurements back then. Back then being, you know, whenever it could be, you know, a few months ago, if it's like a recent sensor that was launched, we have Landsat 7, if you're using Landsat 7, there's a lot of historical context there to be aware of. Or even further back, like, is there a good global density of weather station observations? The answer is no. Social bias, which is, quote, bias can be due to reliance on stereotypes or other broadly shared cultural assumptions or practices. And so the example they give is that forecast accuracy was demonstrated to be improved in locations with higher average household incomes than in locations with lower household incomes, which is unfortunately not super surprising. You know, you're going to have potentially more sensors, like weather observation sensors or funding for balloon launches where there is more funding available, more attention politically. Maybe even NOAA's mission, part two, is to reduce loss of property. First one is life, and then I think it's property. TVA, after most floods, they're like, hey, our actions avoided $300 million in loss. Well, you can really juice that metric if that's the organizational priority by saving the rich people in their fancy houses. I'm not saying that TVA does not do that. TVA is incredibly great. I live in Tennessee. Okay. Then you've got institutional bias, which is the final subcategory. Bias that stems from the norms within an institution, such as academia or the weather enterprise, or from within an agency or organization. So example being forecast being deemed low value after the forecast time had expired, and so they just didn't save them. shout out to dynamical.org. Just kidding. We're not saving anything unique. But maybe one day.
Yeah. Or the type of data, what should be measured, you know, solar irradiance is very sparse to get. But now, you know, everybody's doing who's doing a solar forecast really wants that data. There's just not that much of it.
Yeah. My shout out actually should have been to Radiant Earth Foundation and the Source Cooperative, baby, giving people a place to shove their data before it's too late. Take note, institutions. All right. Next category is human. Marta, you want to run us through these?
Yeah, for sure. I think this category is maybe one that is most applicable to every kind of technology and every discipline. But human biases are essentially those that can stem from mental shortcuts or heuristics and the mental models that people use to work through information and understand things. And those mental models result in biased judgments and decisions. So the first example that they give is information overload. Developers and even end users of AI models can face the exponentially increasing complexity of data. And there's also increasing professional and societal pressures to keep up with that volume of data and research and to use it. So sometimes someone might take a shortcut just because there's so many different possibilities to assess. The second category that they give is attention. So attention kind of determines what information goes into working memory and what gets filtered out. This is definitely driven by exposure to information, physical format, context, personal motivation, societal norms, and this can also really affect the interpretation end users have of AI models, like what kind of preconceived notions they already have is going to affect where they're looking. The next example that they give is working memory. So there's a limited capacity that affects decisions by constraining what is considered and how it is considered at any given time. And then finally, sense making. Humans have this inherent need to make sense of data, and that can really cloud our judgment and choices. We are sort of hardwired to find patterns, so that could impact like how we choose to evaluate our models.
So sense making I find interesting because in many ways the entire alternative to data-driven models is humans having an inherent need to make sense of data and trying to elegantly describe them with equations. I mean, it's not a bad thing. Sense making is a positive, but I think it's great that they call it out as like a potential, like where it could go wrong and create issues, especially with decisions around like verification statistics. This goes back up to, it may be all the way back up at the introduction, but somewhere they're like, no one knows what accurate means. No one agrees on what accurate means. What does accurate mean? And I think sense making is a really important thing as we get to talking more about focusing on use case and the kind of job to be done. The other ones, attention, working memory, and information overload, they're kind of funny because they're like words that mean things in AI, but they're like talking about the human making things. It's like the human's attention and human's working memory, just to be clear, not the like model's working memory. Like, is it a LSTM or whatever? Attention also means something in networks or deep learning. So, but the information overload is I think really important because I've always thought of that as like, hell yeah, information overload. Like, I've done some presentations on the contrast between large language models, which we've thrown a ton of computation at, and they probably are training on a couple petabytes of text, right? Maybe more. I don't know. Now that they're doing images, probably more. But like, you know, there's that public data set that's a bit, 1 petabyte. And then the weather data is probably 1,000 or thousands of petabytes. And in a way, that's like painting the picture for how we can get to an end-to-end AI model and not one trained on reanalysis. And to me, information abundance is maybe how I would frame it instead of, I mean, overload is the bias, but like I've seen it as an opportunity and it's really interesting to see it framed as like a pitfall here.
I think a big difference there is who's consuming it. You know, in a deep learning or a machine learning model, abundance is fantastic. Like if it's high quality, give it more of it. There's really almost no downside to that. Then there's the human side of our human brains are tuned to filter out some things and take shortcuts because that's an efficient way to survive in many, many contexts. And that's like that's a useful thing to do. And yet that kicks in more the more of a fire hose of information that you are drinking from.
The end user side is, I think, especially important here on the information overload, and one that is going to become probably the biggest problem of anything in this paper, which is, okay, hey, here are 12 good weather models. Good luck. And the end user, I mean, truly, that is like information overload. Like, what do I use? In which situations do I have to build my own intuition over time? And we face this a lot with our work on river forecasts. Like, a lot of times people are like, oh, yeah, like, let's try it next to our existing conceptual model so that we could build the intuition. And even that is information overload, right? Like, looking at two forecasts, like, how do you decide if there's a big storm coming, you know, a hurricane's coming, and you're going to get 20 inches of rain. What's the plan?
I see the attention, the working memory, and the sense making all interacting on that question of like, okay, now as a forecast user, I need to make my mental model of what to trust when and how to use these multitude of options I have. And over, myself included, I find we focus on the recent things. Our attention is, you know, it's a relatively short working memory. Our attention focuses on the most intense times, or because we as humans are very loss averse, the times that this one thing messed up, and then those like that gets baked in our sense making, and then we potentially over index on that in how we're evaluating the next round of models. What model I'm going to continue to trust.
We talk about, I just realized the bias we talk about the most in our work day to day is recency bias, which is just the inverse of attention, isn't it? We talk about that all the time, right? Like whether it's recency bias of a customer asking us a question, it's like one customer asked us recently and like I'm hyped on it. And so like now suddenly it's the most important possible thing we could do. Or the recency bias, like you're saying, of like forecast performance. Yeah, totally. Should we run through data bias?
Yeah. Data bias is crucial to understand and address, as the data chosen for AI model training and validation will directly affect the bias of the final AI model. So I think this section is the type of bias that is maybe most uniquely interacting with AI as a tool here, different than other or traditional numerical weather prediction approaches. So the first subcategory they talk about is selection bias. So this is identifying and choosing the data that is going into your model. The most significant thing that's going to change the model is the data that goes into it. And there's lots of interactions there between, you know, the systemic and structural biases and human biases that then weave in into your selection bias here. Then we have interpretation bias. This is a lot of interaction here with the human side of things, but how do we aggregate and make sense and of the data that's coming out of the model? And then the processing bias. In every step of a data pipeline of the data that's going to a model, their developers are making choices about how we transform data, condense data, re-aggregate, structure it, and those have, you know, lots of downstream impacts on what the actual model is that we get out.
Yeah. That last one, I think, is probably the most hidden and lurking and the place for the most, as we call it in the software biz. I actually learned this recently. I'd never heard this before last year, but foot gun, shooting yourself in the foot. I'm nonviolent, but I think that's, I've heard that tossed around in our team very flippantly in a funny way. Because it's like the choices seem so innocent, right? Like, oh, let's like grid it up in this way, or like let's interpolate using like nearest whatever. Like these little choices that can snowball into huge potential impacts, or like little lurking secret errors that get you a year later. You're like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or just like how you chose to store it.
Oh, yeah.
Then impacts how easy it is to get, which then like can even subconsciously impact like the next experiments you choose to try is building a model. So you're like, well, that's going to take 2 days, but I'll just try this other thing because like that'll be quick. And those experiments that you try on a lark can often be where you get these jumps. And maybe that's good because you got lucky in your choice that you weren't considering that much in your processing decision. Or maybe you kind of cut off a road that where like the next happenstance discovery might have been down because we accidentally or just inadvertently made some choice in the processing.
They do say in the processing bias, just one last example, sampling from a 99% 1% split, example, tornadoes, aircraft turbulence, many more rare but impactful phenomena, to a more equitable 50% 50% split may create a model that can predict the rare class, but it may also significantly overpredict the rare class. This is like so tricky, right? Because with all Earth system stuff, you care about, maybe you care about like the low flows or, you know, just the day-to-day solar irradiance or whatever. But in most cases, when you're looking at it from the perspective of like protecting life, it's really the extremes. And I think this is an area where it's been hard like to really get enough training data or evaluation data to know how it will perform in those cases. I think this is going to be like an ever-present challenge. But I saw a paper, I think it was from, is it Pritchard at NVIDIA? I saw this just recently. I haven't read the paper yet, but I'm excited to. It said something about this vaguely. So, you know, search that out. That's probably enough information to know what I'm talking about, right? Oh, you had one last one. Did you talk about physics?
No, yeah. And then physics bias, unique to Earth sciences, are potential biases introduced by the laws of physics, which can limit data availability. A primary example they highlight here is just the locations of ground-based weather radars. That feels maybe more like an institutional bias to me.
Yeah, I think you're misunderstanding it. Like sometimes it's so hilly. Yes, maybe the institution could say, all right, we're going to spend $1 trillion to set up so many radar stations that the hills aren't a problem. But I think what they're saying is like, it's the hills, like the hills block it, you know?
Yes, you're totally right. I absolutely misunderstand.
And this is real in Tennessee. So when we have tornadoes, we have these like a group of volunteers called Nashville Extreme Weather. They live stream every tornado we have. They have the radar up. They're talking through what they're seeing. I learned so much. It's so cool. But there are blind spots, right? And there are times where it like goes behind this one hill that we all know about. And you're like, well, we'll see when it pops out on the other side. All right, statistical and computational bias. So this is the final one. It focuses on the AI model itself. We got AI model bias as the first subcategory. What model do you choose? So I think that's really important. I think in hydrology, this is big. LSTMs were hot, so everyone assumed that was the best tool for the job for a while. Now I think, some people think another one's hot. Like these, the model selection is extremely trendy. I see this all the time. Like as soon as one paper comes out with good results on this one approach, a bunch, like everyone leaps on it. There are, of course, the monks among us that pick the best model for the job, no matter how cool or hyped or uncool it is. But I don't think that's the norm. And then the second form of AI model bias comes from the AI model itself. So I highlighted this. I'm going to just read it verbatim. One of the key issues in applying AI to earth science tasks is that the AI model lacks understanding of the laws of physics. While there is work on developing physics-based AI models, this is still in its infancy, and most AI models are unconstrained by the true physics of a phenomenon and can learn idiosyncrasies of the data. There's so much to unpack here that it's its own paper. We've covered some of the hybrid models. There's obviously some value in an AI model that is constrained or understands, constrained by physics, I guess. True physics also. I like they use the word true physics, not the false, the dark physics.
Heretic physics.
Yeah, heretical physics. But what we've also found is that when you try to force constraint, physical constraints on a system, the model can actually perform substantially worse, right? So an example in hydrology is when we force water balance, the model will actually decrease in accuracy. And this is, of course, because the input, the precipitation is just straight up, it's inaccurate. I think there's this maybe pantheon of the physics AI thing. And I think there's a lot of value there, especially if you're like doing simulations or have perfect data or have some way to handle the imperfect inputs that still then maintains the physical consistencies. But I think we haven't seen hybrid models that perform, or just a physics-based model that performs better than one that is unconstrained. At least I have not seen that as like a trend at all. So I think it's interesting that I see it put on a pedestal as like the thing that we're striving towards, but I don't know if that is necessarily the case. And I think there's the last thing I'll poke at is AI models lack understanding of the laws of physics. What does that mean? Like, what do you mean by that? That's what, we could talk about for an hour. Like, isn't that the whole point? It is gaining an understanding of the laws of physics by looking and understanding the patterns and relationships of the inputs and observations that it is provided. I think, is it that we are taking a human bias that the way we understand physics is the only way for something to understand physics, thus it needs these equations? I take a little bit issue. I highlighted all of that in yellow, and then I highlighted the last sentence in red, which must be a scathing highlight color. A physics-based model, such as a numerical weather prediction model, would still be able to provide realistic answers in situations such as unprecedented heat waves. I hadn't read that since I highlighted it in red. This is like the most common objection we get in our work, which is like, how could an AI model predict something outside of the historical record? And that's not true. It's just not true.
This feels like an institutional bias I hear.
Yeah.
Frequently. And I think a lot of people are taught it in school. Like, this one has it baked in, so therefore it will be good. This one doesn't, so therefore it will be bad in extreme situations outside of the data that have been used. And I'm not sure the data, the actual performance bear that out. And we're also, I think, quite a bit too early in the AI weather model development arc to be able to say that too.
Well, wait, correction though. I mean, so the sentence before my red sentence was AI models that are purely data driven, are successful in many situations, but may struggle, especially in situations outside of the training data distributions. This is a bias thinking only about weather models, but we're talking about Earth systems. Hydrology, you have many universes. Each watershed is a universe, right? And so they're related and interconnected. But just to use the example I'm most familiar with, because I think it immediately and powerfully refutes this, if you train a model in the right way on all of those different watersheds, you can predict something outside of the historical record. Like, we do it again and again. We predict 1,000-year storms more accurately than the conceptual model. We predict droughts that are outside of the historical record. Anyway, moving on. Validation bias. Validation bias can also take multiple forms, all of which interact with the developer's initial choice of model with human biases. And then we got use and interpretation bias. Once an AI model is trained, model developers must choose how to use, interpret, and potentially deploy the model, strongly interconnected with human biases.
Yeah, under validation bias, I underlined the results of explainable AI are often subject to human confirmation bias. So explainable AI methods are, you know, methods that look at what a model has learned and try to tell you in some sort of human understandable terms, like why it did what it did. And I think it's a very, very true statement. The outputs of these things are a little bit like tea leaves, and in some ways, as a human, you can see what you want to in those outputs. Still very useful. Still definitely something we should work on more, but they're not hard and fast. Like, oh, I see the explainable AI method. Check the box that it learned the thing that I wanted it to.
I think that's super interesting, Alden. And I feel like there's obviously such a desire for that, like, explainability. And I feel like we've talked about it on this podcast, of like opening up the black box. And it seems to me like in some way, this is almost like a outcome of that pattern recognition and the sense making that humans are so wired to do.
Yeah. And I think it's worth working at, but some of the core reasons why these types of models are able to outperform a human sitting there and looking at a bunch of numbers and trying to make a guesstimate of what the weather forecast is that they work fundamentally different than our brains. Like, they're slightly inspired by our brains, but they are really very different things. And if we basically constrain our selection of what methods we're going to use to ones that we can understand to some decent extent, we may be just taking off the table a whole suite of approaches and models that might be able to do better. But it's a little scary as a human to acknowledge that there's things that we don't understand.
Yeah, I think that's the foundational tension, or like the foundational question with how we use AI and like what our personal relationships are with it. But it's interesting, just going back to Marshall's point around sense making and just how that kind of underlies almost everything that we're doing. In some way, that desire to make sense of things is like why we're doing any of this work at all, like if science is this explanatory discipline. So it's really fascinating to think about how in our desire to make sense of things, like that is also could be one of our biggest like inhibitors to truly make sense of things.
Yeah, I think the sense making is so, well, let me just say, thus concludes our overview of the taxonomy. And now we're going to just discuss a little bit. I think sense making is so much grander. That's why I liked the first paper we ever reviewed around the limits of predictability, which felt disconnected from just the like, we made a more accurate forecast, to what if our understanding of chaos needs to be reexamined? And I hope to see, and I'm sure there's going to continue to be waves and waves of interesting papers that utilize AI around a more pure sense-making angle. And then I think some that are more applied. What's interesting in the sense-making angle, is there a user? And maybe some of these biases are critical, but you don't have a user. Like, maybe that foils kind of my hypothesis that really narrowly focusing on the end user, it's such like an applied mindset. And I guess, again, interesting bias. Like, I come from such an applied, I'm trying to solve problems, I'm an engineer, where in academia, it's really about like, hey, let's increase our understanding. Although, you know, there's academia in between, there's private sector that does the latter. But that's an interesting human bias, I guess, that's coming to play here too.
There's been this dream in that I think is yet to really be realized in a broad way, but that we humans might be able to learn something from what these models have learned. And in that sense, I think the user there is like another scientist trying to look at what this model has learned and be able to make sense of it themselves, and then distill that down to some new piece of understanding in human terms. That would just be so, so exciting and cool if we can really see that happen in their sciences.
How do we help people that are trying to build weather models or decision tools take these biases to heart as part of their process?
Well, I think I have maybe a little bit of a checklist, but I kind of borrowed from more qualitative research. And I think
nice.
Is a way to make some of these more actionable.
So yeah, let's merge our checklists. Hit us with your first checklist item.
Okay. I think that before doing anything, using the language of bias in addition to technical performance or accuracy is a really important choice to make. And I mentioned that bias is both something that is social and technical. So first, by using bias in this way, I think that the thing that implicitly communicates is that you care about technology and science not being exacerbative forces on injustices, or at the very least, acknowledging that social and cultural values can impact earth sciences. So that's my first checklist is like, do you acknowledge that there is bias?
I think that's great. It can be hard. And I think this is why some of my read and feedback came off as defensive. But as you read more or think about it, hard, like, well, you know, I didn't really think about like spatially chunking it in that way being a significant decision or not. So maybe my first checklist item, and this is building on Anne Bostrom's quote from the newsletter that I read at the very beginning. What are you building for whom? Is there a very specific decision you're trying to aid or question you're trying to answer? Or are you building something more general? I think that's like the first fork in the road. If you are building something that's more narrow, then you can get into much more user-driven, almost like guardrails as you go, to continually ask yourself through the development process, how is it matching those needs? And that's going to, I think, be really important as you go through a lot of these biases. A lot of these biases are not going to be obvious as you go through the process. So there are more questions that we're going to have to ask ourselves. But I think that's the most important one, because I've witnessed in our organization and outside of it, the blinders that you can get as you're going. And those blinders are often both blinders to the original problem you're trying to solve, or the customer you're trying to like help, or the user, not customer and user, but also blinder to these, the import of these, the decisions that seem insignificant as you're going. A lot of times you get to the end of a deep model R&D process and you lift your head up from your little gopher hole and you're like, all right, we're done. And then you look at it in relief to that original end user question or job to be done, and you realize, ah, it doesn't really serve that at all anymore, because we went down all of these different rabbit holes because of convenience for this, or we chose this kind of model architecture, which is for a totally different purpose or whatever. So
yeah, I think that point is great. And what you said about the obviousness of bias not always being there, I feel like is pretty crucial. And one of the reasons why I do think these categories are helpful, but I think it also, like, you have to admit that bias and like technical mastery are different things. And if bias was always obvious, then it would be, you would always catch it in your pursuit for accuracy. And we see that that's not true. And like, that's a pretty radical thing to say in context of like Western science, because it is almost like anti-Cartesian. If we say that like technical mastery and bias are different things, that would mean that, yeah, like you'd always be able to be this perfectly objective observer. You could always, you know, the human and the object are these separate things. And I think that this really complicates that stance that has pretty much like underlying how we do science.
I think another question to ask yourself early on in the process is, what's the status quo? What's the baseline? Because as we go into, you know, further questions where you're trying to tease out certain biases, the answer to most is this bias present is yes. And so then, of course, you're going to try to mitigate it. But also, at some point, there's going to be a deployment question of like, should we deploy this or not? And if you haven't defined what the baseline is, you could get stuck never making incremental progress addressing a bias because the bias still exists in your improved version of what the thing is. If you have a concrete baseline and you really need a specific user and use case in mind in order to define that generally, then you can say, no, this actually did improve on that. It's still not perfect, but it's worth moving forward with.
I'll add one more question. We could just keep tossing questions to ask yourself onto the pile. Preface being, I think we're going to get our vast federal funding for this podcast cut by me saying these words, but that's how committed we are. It's important that we talk about diversity in terms of either the team or the perspectives involved in the development of any of these tools. They say it as one of the last sentences of the paper, interdisciplinary and diverse teams are key to the eventual success of an AI model. And I think this is crucial in direct reflection of the taxonomy. Do we have a diversity of perspectives that help mitigate the potential pitfalls of each of the subcategories? It is easy to get all the way to an end product with no domain expertise because things are kind of pre-processed in such a way that you could just kind of roll with it and focus on building your model and training and eval and just kind of, I have something that's more accurate, everyone. What does that accuracy mean? You probably don't know because you don't have the context of the domain. I think that this is probably one of the most important points of the entire paper, right? Like Earth systems is complicated. It's not even just about having a scientist on staff that did meteorology. It's also like, how could you possibly know about the historical or institutional biases of observation data if you don't have someone who understands that context or at least has the curiosity to like really dig into it?
Yeah, I will say plus one on the diversity of perspectives, assembling a team that has diversity of perspectives, and also will echo like using a diversity of approaches, using a diversity of data. Like if you're going to make a model that is going to be deployed in the global south, like it's helpful to maybe use some data from the global south. And I think what you're saying about like, well, how do you get there? What I have on my checklist is practicing reflexivity, which is totally borrowed from social science. But yeah, questioning your assumptions, challenging your assumptions. And when you realize there's a gap in experience, moving to fill that gap, bringing in a perspective. And so I will even say like, maybe using a more refined term rather than unbiased science, but practicing reflexive science.
I love that. That's really nice. The last question I'll toss on, because I think we could go on this all day for more questions to ask yourself, because the development of these tools is an endless pursuit of refinement, and you will never one-shot it perfectly. But the last question I would recommend you ask yourself is, what are my incentives and how do those compare to the end user's incentives? I think that may be abstract, but what I see happen a lot, especially in the very fast moving, very competitive space of meteorological forecasting, is for for-profit businesses, of course, there's an incentive to demonstrate how your forecast is the most accurate for X. And as we've talked about in previous episodes, you could slice or dice your forecast in a million different ways and find some way generally to emerge by saying it's the most accurate. And I think this is probably going to be one of the harder ones because it is the most kind of at odds with your potential, like the pressures of like your board wanting you to grow by X per year or whatever, and you need to get business, so you need to tell this story of accuracy or performance or whatever, right? Is there any perverse incentive or kind of like misalignment for driving commercial growth that may impact end users in an adverse way? I think that's going to be the hardest to tease apart because it requires like a lot of separation of different pressures. And I know people building things or running businesses are under a lot of pressure.
Yeah. I'm so glad you mentioned this. The whole time I'm just over here saying yes, yes, nodding my head. It's not just commercial things too. You know, these potential misalignments of incentives exist in academia,
yeah, of course,
exist in government. Everybody's got an incentive structure around them, and they may or may not align with your user's incentive structure. And they likely will not entirely, but I think understanding like where they do and don't and recognizing that is so important.
Yeah, that's actually a better way to put it. I rambled for a little bit. How does my incentive structure differ from my end user's incentive structure? And I'm glad you mentioned like government academia having the same kind of challenge.
Yeah, I think the last box on my checklist, and I think it speaks very much to the incentive vibe check, and that's transparency. And I want to first give like a little bit of a qualification that I know that we've talked about. Maybe there's a problem with trying to open up every part of the machine learning process or like open up that black box in pursuit of explainability. But this is transparency that's not necessarily just for deeper explainability, but so that your incentives are clear and your decision making is clear. Because like I feel like we've really harped on it, is there's so many choices throughout the process and they can feel very arbitrary in the moment, but they become sometimes wonderfully deterministic. And so I think doing a really good job of saying why you chose what you did, why you chose what data set you did or so on, feels super important. Maybe that's a big task because there are so many choices, but I think even making, you know, the perspectives that you have on your team really transparent to your end users is also part of this transparency.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I love when a paper will say, we picked this number, it was kind of arbitrary, and we didn't have time to go into it. And that's what it is for now. Because then you like don't over-index on that, like, oh, I should choose 42. You know, you're just like, oh, they just picked 42 because they liked Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And it was good enough, and they moved on, and that wasn't like the key question in this paper.
Well, I think the other part of, you know, making that decision-making really clear and transparent is it makes possible the ability to deploy before perfection, because you can say, like, we didn't have a better data set to use. This is in some way an experiment. We're still working toward something that's even better.
Marta, what are you reading?
My reading recommendation is a watching recommendation. Yeah, so a couple months ago, I saw a musical adaptation of the film Groundhog Day.
Right.
Yeah. And
it was,
oh yeah.
Yeah, a super important text in the meteorological canon. And I don't know if it was just because I hadn't seen the film in a long time or like in the new context of musical theater, I could just really connect with the characters. But the story was moving in a way that I don't really remember it being. And I think that my new read of Groundhog Day is that, and I'm assuming everyone listening knows the general's story, but I think my new read on it is that even when you have like a perfect forecast and you know what the next day is going to look like, we still need to ask ourselves moral questions. And I think that this film is incredibly concerned with how we practice science alongside morality and using these two things or engaging with these two disciplines in step. But it does really remind me of like this core tension that exists between some philosophies and science. And I'm thinking specifically of Weber, who I know I've talked about on the podcast before, and his theory of disenchantment. But Weber was super anti-science, and not anti-science in the way that we use it now. I have no idea if he was vaccinated, but he was like anti-science as a pursuit. And he just like didn't think it was worth the time. And so he has this lecture called Science as a Vocation. And he writes, "Science is meaningless because it gives no answer to our question, the only question important to us, what shall we do and how shall we live?" And then he goes on to say that it has no intrinsic value. It can't explain why technical mastery of the world is desirable or why knowledge itself is worthwhile. And I completely disagree with this. And the first time I read that quote, I don't know why it caused such a big reaction in me, but I think I'm recognizing that for the individual people like practicing science, it feels really untrue. Like the idea that this work is not at all engaged in how we live a meaningful life or how we go through the world and be better people. And so yeah. I think that this is super connected to our paper today of like,
it's so good.
Yeah.
So like, I'll use that as an opportunity to introduce our paper today, which is Tom Hanks as the Divine. Post-production, Marshall. Listen, I know that it's actually Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, but what's interesting is that I have a very distinct recollection of seeing Groundhog Day starring Tom Hanks. And this is my version of whatever the Berenstain Bears thing is. Apparently, Tom Hanks was actually slated to star in this film. So I think I'm just a Voyager from that universe where he really did. Anyway, I'll reference Tom Hanks a few more times. And if you can get your hands on a copy of Groundhog Day starring Tom Hanks, I highly recommend it. His performance was exquisite.
What was that kind of? In one of the episodes, Marta, there's like two kinds of something.
I think, well, there's the two types of chaos. Which
that's what
is,
I'm talking about. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Like type one is that it's completely outside of your knowing. I might have them backwards and is unrelated to whether or not people know about it. And type two is like the stock market, where when people know about it, it's more chaotic.
Right, like because you knowing about it changes your actions, which then have the feedback loop. Groundhog Day is a beautiful illustration of that type two chaos. Tom Hanks is just spiraling out of control with the knowledge of what will happen. And by knowing that, he changes what will happen.
And he becomes a better and more moral person in the process.
That's the most important part. Yeah. Right, yeah. What I'm reading is sort of related. Actually, before I go on, do you think AI, so like imagine a large language model, do you think every time inference is run, it's like Groundhog Day for it and it like wakes up and it's just like, not again. Okay, here's your text.
At what point
will AI have that kind of Groundhog Day experience?
I mean, if it's sentient, then totally. It's like, hate this person.
Up asking me about your medical thing.
Yeah.
What product do you buy?
For me, it's like, stop asking me how to write the HTML code for the same button over and over and over.
I'm reading Gene Wolfe, which is so good. And it actually relates, I think, a little bit to not Groundhog Day, but the quote you read, Marta. I'm reading Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun, which is 4 books, but it's so good. And it's my favorite kind of literature, which is extremely opaque. It feels like you're reading a story through like 7 layers of translucent projector paper and trying to like look through and trying to, you know, you can shift them around slightly to like understand the text. It is an unreliable narrator writing his own, basically like autobiography. Gene Wolfe has a preface that says, "Thank you to the people in the future that sent this text back to me to translate. I have endeavored to create no new words, even though this takes place far, far in the future." Right? Normally in sci-fi, they're like, "Ah, the kerflunk." And you're like, "Oh, what's the kerflunk?" Gene Wolfe uses no new words. He reaches far into antiquity and actually uses a ton of religious words, a lot of religious imagery. Everyone's named after a saint. It is incredible. And it feels like you're reading a medieval fantasy, but then you realize, wait, the walls are metal? Wait, they live in a spaceship that's parked on the ground? You know, it's like these like series of revelations, and it is excellent. It has Ursula K. Le Guin, who's my favorite author's stamp of approval, but it's made me want to go to divinity school, basically, to like understand religion and how like religion relates to these questions we're asking, and like the question or the quote Marta just read, and like the pursuit of knowing and learning and understanding, and like why it matters. And it's just so good. What about you, Alden?
Recently been reading a nonfiction book called Infinite Powers by Stephen Strogaz. It's a, probably pronouncing his name wrong, apologies. It's a popular view look at calculus and describing both the history of it and what it can say about the world. And it's made me realize how in my younger education, I totally missed the point of calculus. And all I learned was these mechanics and this thing. Like I was just learning, like memorizing letters in what he describes as like the language of the universe. And I just completely missed that whole component of it. And it's beautiful and so cool. And it makes me a little sad that I, you know, didn't go further in calculus earlier on. It's so important to all of these things we're talking about right now. It is the language of change in the atmosphere and the rest of our Earth systems. So it's been fun to maybe later in life catch up on that.